Welcome. Who's joined?
Hey, Dave. It's Tom from Connecticut. How
are you? Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing great.
We're hoofing it alone so far. Richard and Tricia are still out with some medical issues and will join us, I believe, by next week.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Well, how are you doing?
Doing great, thank you. Yeah, I'm doing good.
How are things coming for you? Bring me up to date and give me a progress note, and is there any aspect of it that could be helpful for us to talk about?
So I'll know more about my class after May 10th. The board meets second week of every month to look at class proposals. So, you know, I'm hoping for good news.
Who will be the audience for the class?
So it's a community program. So it would be people who live in my town and surrounding towns, and it's advertised. So I missed the date to be in the summer brochure, but they do mailings and other email blasts and things like that to advertise classes that are being offered.
Do you have any notion of who the attendees would be? Are they going to be college students? Is this a community continuing education and adults in the community? Correct.
Think of it as adult education or continuing education, not necessarily college students, but it could be. If you pay taxes in the town and you're a resident, you get mail, and in the mailings are advertisements for things like classes being offered in the community.
Okay.
And if you're a previous customer or participant for other programs in the past, you might be on an email list, and you might get a group email, just letting people.
Is this in your town of Prospect?
It would be in my town of Prospect, and I'm thinking probably surrounding towns. I wouldn't be surprised if I remember when I was taking some classes and looking for like adult personal development classes or continuing education classes, I would sometimes go to the neighboring town to attend the class. So, yeah, so, you know, I think, I don't know what I don't know, but that's my best guess.
What are you doing to develop and expand your platform, your email list and followers? What's that like?
So I haven't done anything yet. However, you know, I think your suggestion last class was really good, and talking with people about what I'm doing will probably be my next step. I've been on a couple of website development pages to maybe start thinking about developing a website. And I also,
Which of the suggestions last time are you referring to that you thought you'd follow up on?
Correct. Talking with people I know.
Because I'm not clear what you're referring to.
Yeah, talking with people that I know to let them know I'm considering doing money coaching.
Okay.
I think I want to wait until after May 10th to really push that conversation and have those conversations even more, because I have had some conversations already with people, but I think once I have a class to say, you know, I'm doing money coaching, you know, I'm teaching a class that's starting, you know, in June, you know, why don't you check it out? Here's a flyer or here's some information about it. So I think I'm sort of there. You had mentioned getting a blog going, so I did a little research on that in terms of how to do that, and I've also been looking into developing a website.
Yeah.
And I sat down and put together my first class. So my class one is done.
I think of all the things you can do starting a blog, that would be where I would begin if I were starting out today as day one coaching. I'd start a blog because that way you can address what you're interested in, learn more about what you're writing, develop an editorial calendar, and expand your reach and get people to sign up for your blog and really convey information, but also do it in a way that it reaches beyond your geographic area because you have an international venue with a blog, and if you're a search engine attuned, then it can be picked up by other blogs, and you just learn more about what you're writing.
That sounds great. I think I need to understand a little bit more about, you know, what goes into setting one up. And then I think about, once I have it set up, what am I going to write about?
You can do all of that in a parallel process, because the format, the platform for doing a blog, like for WordPress or any Blogger.com, there are a number of blogging platforms that you don't have to have a website to do a blog. You can start with a blog. There are some people who have only a blog and don't have a website. Seth,
right,
one of the best-known marketers in the world, has done 10 bestsellers out of his blog. He does not have a website, but he promotes his books through his blog and does that regularly.
Okay.
So you don't have to have a website. You can just do a blog. The thing I would be aware of is, have your own domain name so that the platform can be your name or your coaching firm instead of blogger.com/, Tom's coaching, whatever, so that it
gives
the full name of your firm or your coaching entity or just your name, rather than an add-on to their name, because that's easy once you get your domain name. So I'd look at domain names too.
Right. I think, there's so many new things to do, and I think you're right. Doing the first two or three that will get me the most return is important. So you think a domain name and a blog.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those are the two I'd do. And I think you can begin your practice now and call yourself a financial coach or money coach. Send out a letter of announcement to people you know, and explain what you do. It can close a couple of cards. I would do it hard copy. And, just follow up with them and be ready to talk with people about coaching.
And I think that's key, is feeling like I'm ready to do that. And I think I'm right there. And maybe I've created this obstacle in my own mind that I'm not ready until I start teaching. And
and that's why I'm addressing this, because I think that is an obstacle, and I think you're very right. There are only three things you need to start your coaching practice. One is a business card, two is a landline with a headset, and three is a story.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't include teaching at a college in the above.
Notice. Yeah. All right. Landline, business card, and a headset.
Yeah, because a landline means you can work with anybody in the world with good reception, and you have a telephone number that is dedicated to your coaching practice, so that when somebody calls, they'll hear a message and hear maybe, if you include when you'll get back with them, so they can leave the number of where they'll be between, 4 and 4:30 that whatever. But it's just beginning. And think about the people and go the lowest hanging fruit and look at introducing them to your practice.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I'm there, and it's exciting to be right there. And exciting probably has a whole bunch of other feelings attached to it,
And be sure you read that feeling in the right way. The exciting can be read as anxiety, and that if it's interpreted in an old model equals danger, better head for cover, or keep saying I'm going to do it when. And the excitement is reframed a validation of moving ahead, a signpost of being exactly where you want to be, and an impetus then to take the next step. And this is going to be the same little juncture that you'll notice with every client who engages in change, because change is going to be a mixed bag, because it's going to create anxiety and uncertainty, but also be exciting about the possibilities.
Yeah, I think you nailed it, and I think that's what I'm reading is, you know, the excitement has some other emotions, you know, hitchhiking on it as well.
Yeah.
And
think about, this is for coaching purposes as well as your own self-reflection, think about how we have to label a feeling right. Because if
Correct.
We label a feeling wrong, we're going to write the wrong story. If we say, let's say no to somebody and feel guilty, then
yeah.
we're booting up a particular mindset that's based on feeling guilty. If, however, no simply means no, I have a priority and this is what I want to do and this is what I've decided at this point, and thank you, but I'm choosing other things right now, that's a very different mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Two different ways to proceed based on accurately labeling your own experience.
I agree. So
go ahead. You want to add?
Well, just back to the business end of it, and it's because there's things I don't know about, and I was thinking about finding someone who's has more background knowledge regarding the internet and setting things up in a digital way. It's when I select a firm name, my company name, my business name, if I decide to do that instead of my name, is that better? Because in terms of when people do a search, our searches generated alphabetically, so, you know, my first and last name falls further down the alphabet line than if I selected a firm name that has, you know, an A in it or a B in it, you know, something like that. Does that make sense? Am I asking the question?
I understand the sense it
yeah.
makes to you, but it's not the way it works.
Okay.
The way it works, if somebody searches something, they're going to search based on search words. And this is something you can do as you begin to write a blog, is to go to Google Alerts. First of all, Google Alerts. And then type in the names, type in whatever you want to get information about. Like I get
right.
a couple of dozen on a regular basis. And if it's two words or more, type it in quotes so you get for the phrase. So if it's quote, behavioral economics, or whatever you're interested in following, type it in, and they'll send you the articles each day if you elect that have to do with that, from articles to blogs. That's how your blog goes viral. And whenever I have a blog that has in the title or in the first paragraph the word neuroeconomics, then that blog will appear in my email box under the neuroeconomics search for that day of articles that are relevant. So that's how it works. So it doesn't make a difference in terms of anything that you're talking about in terms of whether it's your name or a firm name. If you can think of a firm name that really grabs you, then I'd say go with that.
Okay.
David, can I just add, I hired a branding person to help me.
Yes, that's what I'm
thinking
about.
A lot of this kind of work.
Okay.
Yes.
And when I was speaking to them, because, I mean, I have a company name and I have my personal name, and they were saying to me how things are changing a lot, where people want to be doing business with a person a lot more than wanting to do business with a company. And she actually recommended that I use my own name as the main brand, and then, you know, my company name is a smaller brand, because she was saying, everything I do from my blogs to my website, I use photographs of myself so that when people are coming on to do the coaching, they actually feel like they're with a person. They feel like they know my own personal story. So, I mean, by being a little bit more vulnerable and being a person with your own story, people find it easier to be able to share their own stories. And that's how I've created my brand with all the content that I send out. And I must say, it's worked really well for me.
I think that makes more sense as a professional who operates with a professional practice, that it's your name and it's not primarily the firm name, because everything that's happening is happening with you. Now, if you want to develop a firm with products and autonomy, then you may think about the other. Let me send each of you a little document that has a couple of things, a little bit about brand, but mostly I'm thinking about it because it has about, how to brainstorm a business name. I reduced the process that I went through to come up with MentorPath to put it in a three-step process that may be helpful to create a business name if you're interested in that. I'll send it as a document attached so that you can look at it and see if it might be of help to you at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. And, Kim, thank you for that. That's perfect.
Yeah, great ideas. Well, Kim, also bring us up to date. What's going on with you?
Yes, I mean, besides for the fact that I had a holiday, which was great to have a holiday, but I always find when I have a holiday, I come up with lots of ideas. It's really my creative time.
Maybe
but,
you
I mean,
are
I've had
that in then on a more regular basis.
Yeah, I spend a lot of my holidays reading and writing.
For the country to decide.
Well, I'm fortunate having my own business. I do take off the school holidays with my children.
Exactly.
So when they're on holiday, I'm on holiday, which seems to be quite often.
That's great. Yeah.
I start my own radio program as of next week, where I'm going to be. So it's a similar thing, really, to me as a blog, because on the radio program, it's not a long program. I get 15 minutes every single week, and like I would write different blogs, I've actually chosen different topics out of the work that we've been doing with you. And then, you know, I'll go on and discuss that, give a few questions, and then I followed up on my website with the blog that relates to it. So that's very exciting news for me.
That's a great
And then
idea
I think between
to repurpose what you do on radio as a blog so that it's all in the same flow, and you get more service out of your creative product. So that's terrific.
And I mean, what I do with that as well is I follow through to my Facebook, my LinkedIn, my Twitter, so I can multi-purpose. Because if you're trying to recreate for all these different platforms, it becomes a full-time job, and you don't really have time to do coaching.
And you know what that collection of blogs and radio shows, that content, is also called?
No.
A sequel to your book.
Yes. Okay. Totally agreed.
About half of my sequel to The Secret Language of Money came from my blogs, something I resisted doing when McGraw-Hill insisted that I do a blog. And then I got into it, liked it, really saw a lot of things that were bloggable, and really just totally enjoyed the process and developed a following from that, and you know, really loved the material and that I was creating, and saw a lot more possibilities than I would have if I hadn't done the blog. So that can be a real creative process in itself. And I know Tom's listening because he's about to do a blog.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
And then what I also find is where I get responses from clients,
exactly,
or from readers.
Yeah.
Then I know where they're more interested.
See, in that way, you can also ask for responses. At the end of a blog, you know, I'm interested in your response, or what's your reaction to this, or raise a question. Same with radio. Even if you don't do a live, you know, call-in deal, you can still ask for responses and, you know, get responses from listeners. Is it live, or is it just, I mean, I know it's live, but is it call-in?
So there's different ones. I do. This particular one's not going to be call-in, but I mean, I do ones as well that are call-in.
Well, that's great. You get all kind of information that way. I think that's terrific.
It is.
You have a finger on the pulse of your potential clients and the public, and see what they're interested in. So that's great. I don't know if you heard at the very beginning, I had a note from both Richard and Tricia. They're not going to be able to join us today, so we're it for today. So anything else, what I would like to do is to begin to schedule the presentation of a roadmap case study. I'd like to begin May 17th and do it the 17th, 24th, 31st, and June 7th, and leave our final date of the class June 14th to look at some end game things and wrap up, as well as the seminar that we do that day. So May 17th, 24th, 31st, June 2nd, would either of you like to volunteer for any of those dates to present? Again, it's just going to be maybe a 15-minute time, and presentation will be maybe half of that, and then we'll discuss it. And it's a short write-up, and you see about the length in that e-book that I sent with the different case studies and the five different subjects.
I'm happy to do any of the dates.
Okay, you want to start with the 17th?
I'll do the 17th.
You're down. Okay, great. Thank you for volunteering. Tom,
no problem.
I think that I'll do the 24th. I think it'll be helpful to see it, you know, modeled on the 17th, and
okay.
And I'll send you any questions I have, you know, even before the 17th, just to start preparing
okay, sure.
for it. Very good.
And again, remember the ebook. It has I think 32 different roadmap case studies. The idea of doing that was to enhance your practices and look at developing your practices by giving someone a free download to see the possibilities of working with a mentor coach in the various areas. And one of the five sections is on money stories. So my hope is that it will be a catalyst for your potential clients.
That's fantastic. Now, when you say the e-book that was sent to us,
When you signed up in the initial
yeah.
Response I sent around, there was a link to the ebook Successful Life Story Transformations. Do you still have that? Let me.
I will definitely.
I'll resend it when I send the brainstorming for a business name.
Okay. Thank you for doing that.
Sure. Sure. You'll see how you can just simply have the link that's the name of the book that somebody can click on and go to and sign up and get an immediate download of the book.
Okay. Well, that might be a nice way to really get me to have some time with a real person to maybe do a case study.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Unless I'm understanding it, but you know, I'll get
you
caught up.
See how you'd like
that.
To use it. You may wanna assign something from it for a class.
Yeah. Okay.
Somebody to report on a case study or report on a section, or I don't know. You'll see what.
All right.
See if it grabs.
Yeah, I'll take a.
Okay.
So what I'm going to present on the 17th, are you going to give us more details of what you're looking for then?
Just a roadmap case study on yourself.
Can you do it on yourself? That's what I was meaning.
Organized
yeah.
around the seven steps, and you'll see in the ebook a simple way of reporting and summarizing each of the components, each of the steps.
Yes. That was my original thought, is that I would do it on myself. But listening to you, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, but listening to you makes me think about perhaps, you know, doing it with another person as a way to start doing work with a client. But I'll take
I'm
a look
not,
at it.
I'm not sure I'm agreeing with what you're saying. I don't think it's
Good.
A way to start doing work with a client.
Good.
It's a way to use the roadmap system to work with someone for this is more for you perhaps than it is for the client, although it can certainly be used in, you know, individual or group or workshop situations, that you can have a way to systematically look at understanding a relationship with money and creating a revised or a new money story. And the roadmap is simply the 7 steps to really understand and construct a story. Look at the explanation and look at some of the examples, and I think it'll make sense to you.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm going to move us to our topic today. We're going to talk about master states of mind. So hold on, I'll put us on lecture mode.
Okay, can I just say...
To discuss mastering states of mind, I'd like you to imagine that you're at an auction. The room is filled with 75 sophisticated-looking people in business attire. The auctioneer walks in, holds a $100 bill before the group, and he explains the auction scenario. Bids move in $5 increments. The highest bidder wins the bill. The second highest bidder pays the bid but gets nothing in return. And he reminds, this is real money. So the bids start. Within seconds, the bids pass $100. Some of the 75 people push the bidding up above $300. Two people get into a bidding war. One of them ends up paying $465 for the $100 bill. The other writes a check for $460 and gets nothing. Now, how could this actually happen? Well, this scenario has already happened more than 600 times. The auctioneer, Professor Max Bazerman. The setting, Harvard's JFK School of Business, School of Government, rather. The participants, investment specialists and economic gurus. These were not undergraduates. These were senior people. Some of the brightest financial experts consistently paid 3 to 4 times the worth of the $100 bill just because of the way their minds work. And this isn't a stock whose perceived value is determined only by the bid. Professor Bazerman commented, I've never seen bidding stock below $100 in any one of the more than 600 times I've done it. And I did a keynote a couple of times and did this scenario, and two different people came up to me afterwards and said, that's exactly the way it happened. I was in that audience with Bazerman when he did it. Neither one of them would own how far they went with it. So now here are the contributions from the mind. Loss aversion. I'm not going to be the second highest bidder, still pay and get nothing. Studies show that losing $100 makes you twice as unhappy as gaining $100 makes you happy. The sunk cost fallacy. Well, I've already bid $260. I'm just going to go $10 higher and hear how this segmentation puts it in a different framework. So what happens in the first part of the bidding when somebody thinks they're going to get $100 for less than $100 is different than in the second half of the bidding where somebody stays with the bidding even though they know it doesn't make sense because they don't want to lose the money. They avoid losing rather than trying to gain, and they deal with it and justify it incrementally. And here's some contribution from the brain. Prefrontal cortex says stop at $95. Limbic system says, I'm excited, I'm going to win, I can't stop now. Our states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. In that auction room, brains were on a collective tilt. The herd mentality was running wild. But now here's that conversation even without that emotional contagion. Prefrontal cortex says, let's save for retirement. Limbic system says, let's have that second cognac and order the 27-inch iMac. Money behavior and financial decisions are sometimes, rarely, actually about money. If money were about math, no one would have personal debt. And $100 would be simply $100 instead of another number based on another state of mind. Here's one more brief scenario. 433 people voted on a proposal. It failed. If only 12 of those 433 people had voted yes instead of no, the outcome would have been exactly the opposite. The result in the next few hours the stock market lost $1.2 trillion. Here's what one senior equity trader on Wall Street said. You just felt like the world was unraveling. People started to sell, and they sold hard. It didn't matter what you had, you sold. This collective tilt shows how states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. This was the vote on the mortgage bailout in late 2008, and it crystallized an entire economic scenario of events. Chuck Prince, the then head of Citicorp, said, as long as the music was playing, it's like you had to get up and dance. Greed, emotional contagion, peer pressure, each can trump logic. When you see friends, for example, making significant profits, trading stock or flipping real estate, the natural inclination is to want in on the action. As more join the movement, prices rise, and for a while, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But then some event reverses the momentum, bursts the bubble, and turns optimism into panic. Herd mentality pushes people to either join the momentum, either way, to buy or to flee. And people aren't stupid, they're just not regulated. They make mistakes, they buy low and sell high, either because they don't have a plan or they don't stick to it when emotions vault beyond the fence of that plan. Even when they're finance or economic experts, they pay $350 for a $100 bill. Or, remember the other study, over $6 for a stock they know is worth $3, twice in a row. They don't suddenly get smart the third round. They learn to regulate. Google announced its financial results for the fourth quarter on January 31st. Revenues were up 97%, net profit up 82%. Phenomenal growth. Yet Wall Street analysts had predicted even better. Their expectations were just above what the actual outcome was, because the actual outcome failed to meet what the analyst guessed it would be. Google lost $22.3 billion in value in a matter of minutes before trading was halted. So, was it the mind of the investors or the actual value of the company? Well, because of the way our minds and brains work, it turned out to be both. Not the intrinsic value, but the paper value. The great investment analyst Benjamin Graham was asked what it takes to be a successful investor. His response? People won't need extraordinary insight or intelligence. What they need most is the character to adopt simple rules and stick to them. Bazerman's auction is an example of creating a bubble. Bubbles are a market phenomenon in which value is inflated significantly beyond its basic worth. In other words, a collective state of mind. So, let's look at regulating states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. A state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavior patterns. A key element of coaching is helping a client become aware of various states of mind with particular focus on which state works best for what purpose. A model of mind and regulation of state of mind and regulation of state, is the infant-adult interaction. In any one moment, the infant is totally in a particular state, contentment or upset or hunger, and the adult empathically resonates with this state in order to lend the function of regulation until the infant is soothed. Or if the infant is just totally inconsolable and so upset, we may find that just simply doing something to change the state can instantly work, like jangling car keys. And this is the impact that questions do in mentor coaching. Someone is talking, they're into their third paragraph, and you ask a question. It immediately refocuses that person on your question. So this borrowed regulation that we see in growth and development is gradually internalized to form self-regulation. This is the foundation of collaboration and contingency in adults and of mentor coaches with clients. We engage in collaborative conversations with our clients to help them understand and regulate states of mind. So that's also why coaching needs to be heart-based and brain-based for balanced learning and growth. Left brain plus right brain, emotional plus intellectual. And we now know that this collaborative communication and empathic connection creates new neural connections and networks in someone's brain. So here's a mentor coaching application. It's important for us as mentor coaches to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand the subjective experience as well as the story communicated by the client. Now, developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally, develops emotionally before the verbal linguistic abilities of the left brain mature. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a direct right brain to right brain communication of emotional states of coach and client. So, as mentor coaches, we must remain open to receiving communications from the client's right brain to become attuned to the state of mind of the client, because this precedes planning and synthesizing. And this is what I have mentioned before, and I want to reiterate now about how state always needs to come first before strategy and story, because when someone is grounded and centered, they have access to all of the information in all of their states of mind. Whenever anyone is in an altered state of anxiety, of rumination, of upset, of preoccupation, whatever that altered state is, if it compresses the focus and compromises an ability to access all of information, the first order of business is to help somebody get grounded and centered and to then be able to engage with us in a more meaningful way. There have been a handful of times when, for example, a client has just had something happen right before they call that has been so upsetting or preoccupying that they will want to postpone or reschedule our time. And I would ask them then if we could just do a relaxation. They would like to do a relaxation exercise for just a minute or two. And when they agree, we do it, and they inevitably then find this as a way to get grounded and centered and use the session in a much more meaningful way. My contention is this first 2 minutes is the most important thing that happened in that entire session, because this is what they're downloading in the process that we're engaging, a way to self-regulate. And I think I've mentioned this before, a couple of articles recently in Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review emphasize that the premier quality of executives is self-regulation and the ability to self-reflect. And that supersedes all other qualities and benefits that someone brings to that position or capacities that they bring to that position. So this is something that we do with a client because the state of mind determines the meaning that we attach to something, and the meaning we attach determines our behavior. That's why state comes first, before strategy and story. So somebody comes in or begins to work with you, it's tempting when they present something to immediately move to a strategy of looking at how to understand a situation and looking at moving into a coaching model with that, rather than empathically resonating with their experience in order to establish not only a common ground to move ahead, but the mindset of collaboration. Remember, we talked about conversational intelligence, and the first few words boot up a particular mindset. If that mindset is one of connection and collaboration, then it's mediated by oxytocin, the chemical of bonding. And that processes the entire remainder of the conversation. If the first few words boot up a mindset that's mediated by cortisol or adrenaline, then the whole issue is of trust and perhaps a defensive or less than fully engaged position to move forward. So that's why state comes first. So the empathic resonance establishes a common ground, and it establishes a mindset in the client to move ahead with us in a collaborative process. And that's the basis. That's the fundamental difference of coaching from any other profession in terms of the framework, that it's a collaborative framework. And that includes then everything that follows from that framework, that it's problem solving, but it's not a consultative model where you present the issue to the expert, the consultant, whether it's physician, attorney, whatever the professional consultant is, and the professional consultant tells you what to do. This is different. This is a coaching framework where we together co-create a new story with a client. So then when this regulation of state of mind is addressed, then together we can explore possibilities, experiences, brainstorm, and plan. And this resonance can creatively transform an experience into new ideas, co-creations, where either might not have been able to go before. So let me give you an example of just a very simple example of how a state of mind determines the meaning we attach. You're at home, you've just had a nice dinner, you're having an enjoyable conversation with your partner, you hear something in the backyard, you may not even process it. If you do, kind of dismiss it because you stay focused in the flow of that conversation. Next night, you're home alone, you've just seen Criminal Minds on TV, and you hear the same noise, and you're alert, and you have to go check it out just to be sure because it gives you some concern. Same stimulus processed through two different states of mind to take the same person to two different places in terms of a meaning that's attached and behavior that then results from that. So that's, I believe, something important to remember, is that state of mind determines the meaning we attach. Meaning we attach determines our behavior. This is one of the reasons it's so useful to regulate states of mind. So the neuroscience of decision and conflict is something I want to mention just briefly. Let's say you see a car swerving into your lane, headed directly for you. In a matter of a couple of seconds, your life could be over. As soon as you perceive the danger, you reflexively hit the brake pedal and horn, turn the steering wheel very quickly. So in a matter of a second or two, your physiology has changed. You're exhausted, short of breath, heart racing. Emotional chemicals triggered by an automatic alarm reaction instantly change your state of mind to one of survival. Now, each thought and feeling has a chemical consequence. The chemicals of emotion alter mind and body. And then our personal experience determines which state of mind we choose, even though it doesn't feel like a choice because it's often automatic, to process the data and how to respond. And so when whatever we see or experience resembles a threat or danger, it can instantly trigger an emotional and biochemical response. And these chemicals of this emotional state can hijack the logical, rational brain, because this is geared, this response is geared for survival. But when it's not actually for survival, even though it's activated that state, then we can make bad decisions at times. So these are just some things to think about in terms of understanding states of mind and to regulate states of mind, both for ourselves and for our clients. Now, let's look a little bit at choice enhancement. These are some considerations that apply to emotions and choices. Increased tension can produce emotional regression. In other words, a state change back to an earlier time in one's life. With increased tension, stress response reaction can move somebody into an emotional pattern that's more characteristic of a much earlier stage. Increased emotion also narrows perspective. Somebody can be so preoccupied with something that they're focusing on a very narrow band of data, and when there's a more emotional charge, we tend to focus more on the recent event. The recent experience is more in the foreground. It's the recency effect. And when somebody's in an upset state like that, paradoxically, attempting to use reason and logic with them will absolutely backfire. It will deepen their automatic alarm pattern. The escalated individual will further escalate, dig in his toes, and spiral into perhaps more extreme responses and move further away from logic, because they're trying to get the other person, the mentor coach in this instance, to understand the upset, and the mentor coach is not doing it but stays in logic, so the person escalates and gets frustrated in feeling ineffective in getting the coach to understand, and then there's a kind of induction of that frustration in the coach, so the coach feels frustrated, and it looks like a response, but they're in a very parallel process. So when you're in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings for yourself and for a client and restore that balance of right and left brain, the balance of being grounded and centered to have access to all the states of mind, to all the information that you possess. When you're grounded and centered, that's when you have access to all of the information in all of your states of mind. So think about how also when you are aware of this and aware of how to enter and exit states, there's some examples of this in the curriculum. When you're aware of this, it can help you manage your energy a lot better. You know, for example, it's been said that it takes as much energy to turn a TV on as it does to run it for the next 3 or 4 hours. Same with your changing of state. It takes as much energy to change your state as it does to sustain a state for a much longer time. So what this means is that it probably will be very inefficient for you to do a chore, see a client, do some writing, do a chore, do something else, and go back and forth all day. It will be more efficient to cluster the activities that require the same state of mind so you don't have to enter and exit the state of mind and use all that energy. You can just stay in the flow of that. And here's where an awareness of your biorhythms can come into play, to be aware of what part of the day are you most creative. And, for example, to preserve that time, and schedule and structure an optimum use of that time, to schedule all of your chores at the same time. You know, a personal example. I come from a farm and ranch and got up to milk the cows and feed the cattle from about age 8 on. So somehow that kind of etched my biorhythm. I'm still a morning person. And I don't plug in my phone from 6 to 9 in the morning. That's my time. That's when I write, when I create, when I do whatever I'm doing. And then I look at the rest of the day and structure it according to my biorhythms. About 2 in the afternoon, kind of a natural time that I slump a little bit, that's when I'm working out every day. And then this can inform what you do and to preserve and protect that time so that you're at an optimum functioning for doing what you do and matching the optimum state for a particular task. You know, another very simple example, writing and editing, two very different states of mind, using two different parts of the brain, not to go back and forth, to maybe do writing at your more creative time, editing at times when you have a segment of time that, you know, you might not otherwise use, or you can segment that time and do editing, get into and out of that state. I do a lot of my editing on a plane or, you know, at a time that, you know, you get the point. I'm going to spare you here. So I want to save some time to discuss with you with a discussion to see what kind of questions and thoughts you have about this, but I want to elaborate just a little bit more about how to regulate states of mind, because the most important thing I think we can do to achieve and sustain success is to manage emotions and regulate a state of mind. For example, what do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain, Philip Seymour Hoffman. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing and regulating their states of mind using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you choose, determines the meaning you attach, and the meaning you attach determines your behavior. So, there are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: focus and physiology. Focus is what and how you focus your thoughts on. And physiology is how you use your body. So, here's a simple way of thinking about that, and I will send you an attachment, but I wanted to develop it together with you. Take a piece of paper and draw three vertical lines. So you have four columns. First column, put emotional trigger. Second column, put usual response. Third column, put mantra. And a mantra is simply three parts: a cue, a focus, and a physiology. Fourth column, put ideal behavior. Now, here's an example of what I want to elaborate on. I want to tell you a story about how much of a difference a mantra can make. And a mantra, again, is a cue, something you just do to remind yourself to do the focus and the physiology. And the focus can be simply a phrase, or and the physiology can be simply taking in a deep breath. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach Robert Reed arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw shooting in their division nationwide out of 217 teams, dead last. So, first thing he did during practice, Reed urged each player to develop a mantra. What he suggested was that each player dribble twice as they got to the free throw line to shoot, to dribble twice as a reminder to do their focus and physiology. The focus phrase he suggested was relaxed and smooth, but he emphasized they create their own phrase, and to take two deep breaths in, one for relaxation, to breathe out tension, and to repeat that, so that in 5 or 6 seconds, while they were dribbling, they were doing the focus and the physiology. And they did this for each shot in each practice. After 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. Now, this is something that I found immensely useful in coaching, and I developed this chart that you just drew that I'm calling the neural conditioning chart that I'm going to send you a copy of, note here, to use with clients. I developed this with an executive woman who had difficulty. She was very successful in every way except in one area. She had a meltdown every time she went back to her family for a major holiday. And we were working together, and she was doing some very successful work, and mentioned this before she went home for Thanksgiving. What I recommended to her, after hearing what this was like for her, and despite her best efforts, she could hold it together for sometimes almost a day, but then it would just cumulatively wear down, and she would end up being in fights and all kinds of stuff. And I asked her first, what's the age of that conversation? And I didn't have to explain that. She knew exactly. She said, I'm 13 all over again. And that's exactly what it was like when I was, 12, 13, 14, 15, every day in my family. So I recommended to her that she schedule a brainstorming time with herself to set aside maybe 30 or 45 minutes that she would write down all the specific triggers or cues that would set this in motion when she was with her family. And to do this in a way that she would stay grounded and centered and observe this. In other words, not to re-enter this state, but to be aware of it and look at it as an observer, just to be aware of all the triggers and not have them be triggering. To write down all the triggers and what the usual response was. And it was subtle things like the way her dad would roll his eyes or the way her brother would torque her or a phrase that her mother would use. It would just set her off. And she had no trouble coming up with a significant list. And I suggested then a second time that she also schedule a brainstorming time with herself, develop a mantra, develop something, since she wasn't going to carry a basketball with her, develop something that she could do, a simple little cue that she could use to remind her to the focus and the physiology. And what she decided to do, she had a ring on her right hand. She decided to touch her ring. That would be her reminder that she would then use a phrase that she would repeat to herself silently as a way of focusing, aligning the energy field in her brain, and to take a deep breath of relaxation and to breathe out any tension. And to practice doing this again and again so that ultimately, although not the first Thanksgiving, not the first major holiday, but ultimately she could simply touch her ring and get instantly grounded and centered. And she decided later to do that before she would give a keynote or before a board meeting, any kind of thing that she needed to be really grounded and centered. And she did this again and again, and I emphasized to her when she went home to be aware of what she had written in the first two columns, because the purpose of that is not to focus negatively, but the purpose is to cue your radar to be aware of these triggers and the instant responses from the state change in the second column. And all the content of the second column is the state change material. That's not going to change. That's always going to be there. That content is always going to be like when she was 13 and 14 and 15, all that self-talk and the negativity and why can't I do better. That's not going to change. The therapy that she had tried on that didn't work because you can't go from column two to column four. You can't go from one state to another. You have to get grounded and centered first. And getting back into that state, which was the nemesis of therapy, meant that she reentered that state and tried to work on it and understand it and resolve it and have catharsis and all that, but it just etched it further because every time you go back into a state or a problem, you etch it further. So that state change, she's aware of this time. So the first two columns is to make was to make her aware of her experience, to cue her radar to be aware of it so that she could more quickly each time get grounded and centered, column 3, and move to an ideal response, column 4. And I emphasized to her that in the beginning, this is going to be a challenge because when you go all the way across, ultimately, you'll rewire your brain because that's why it's a neural conditioning chart. You're going to use a familiar cue instead of creating a state change. You're going to have an ideal behavior that you've already pre-planned that you'll get to after getting grounded and centered. It's going to be a hard work miracle, though, in the beginning because you're going to have to get grounded and centered several times during a conversation. And remember, you can always call a timeout. This is not the NBA. You have an unlimited number of timeouts. If it gets tough, you can excuse yourself and go to the bathroom, splash cold water on your face, or take a walk. When she got back, she reported that it was the best holiday she had ever had, the best time she had ever had in her life with her family. And she was aware of the various things that they did to, you know, have changed back pressure to something they were familiar with, and she didn't succumb. She succumbed slightly a few times, but worked on it, took a hike, you know, or went to the back, and really regulated her state of mind. So that's an example of self-regulation that I think can be particularly useful. An example, like before I do a keynote or a workshop, I will simply put my index finger and thumb together on both hands, forming little circles, and touch them in the middle, form the infinity sign. Have a focus phrase, relaxed and powerful, and take one deep breath in of relaxation and breathe out tension, or just take a deep breath for relaxation, and in a few seconds, I'm in an optimum state for performing whatever I do. Now, if you want, for example, to think about entering a different state, like if you want to go to sleep more effectively, then think about a different focus phrase. A focus phrase of, you know, relaxed and powerful is not going to get you to sleep real quick. You may want to do relaxed to sleep. So the phrase needs to match what you want to do, the state you prime yourself for the optimum performance of that task. Optimum performance may be more effectively and quickly go to sleep, or it may be to be in a state where you're primed for an optimum performance intellectually or even physically. So just some things to consider. Just a couple of things to mention, then I want to save some time for discussion. Insight changes the brain and shifts state of mind. Whenever somebody has a moment of insight, an aha moment, three different parts of our brain light up, and we're vaulted into a state that is more synthetic and integrative and creative. And this is what we do in coaching, to create and co-create aha moments, to activate centers in the brain that have to do with processing things in a more creative way. So now, important as this insight-induced process is, sustaining attention is what hardwires it in the brain circuit. One more final thing that I want to mention, a story and then some steps to use to master emotional triggers. So just to mention the story about pleasure and the hedonic treadmill. This is something that actually the first description of the hedonic treadmill was by Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel laureate, and he talked about how people, when they acquire more money, buy more things, and it keeps more and more escalation to have even the same kind of pleasure. An example of this, in my view, is from the original episode of the TV series Twilight Zone. It involves a lifelong troublemaker and gambler, Rocky Valentine, who's killed after robbing a pawn shop. He wakes up in the presence of an older guy in an immaculate white suit and tie who introduces himself as Pip. and informs Rocky that he knows everything about him, that he's his guide in this life. And he's devoted to giving Rocky everything he wants, whatever that might be. And Rocky's dazzled by the idea that he can, in this afterlife, he can do whatever he wants to do. He's dazzled by the wardrobe. He sees cash, beautiful women consistently winning at gambling, but he keeps wondering what the catch is. After a month of these excesses, especially winning every game and his favorite, roulette, he wins huge every time, but he gets bored and he gets restless. The thrill of winning every hand gets stale. It's predictable. He's tired of women who dote on him. Finally, after thinking about it, he says, "Pip, I don't belong in heaven. I don't fit here. I want to go to the other place." Pip replied, "Mr. Valentine, this is the other place." Now, one thing that I want to mention here about steps to use the information of feeling to master emotional triggers. Be aware of your feeling. This is column one. Be aware of the emotional state the feeling represents. Column two. Track your emotional state to be aware of what the usual course is, but specifically be aware of the triggers so that you can identify the trigger, and then as soon as you identify the trigger, have in place the mantra and an ideal response so you can immediately go there. You don't have to think it through. You already have it pre-planned for each emotional trigger. And the more you do that, the more you move from what usually has been triggering, getting grounded and centered, and to generate an ideal response, this rewires your brain. It takes a while, but eventually the trigger will be a cue for something quite different, something that is an ideal response, and this is why it's useful to have it pre-planned so you can create consistency about that. Discussion mode now. Tell me if this makes sense to you. How does this fit with what you think about and how you see it useful or not in working? Does it make sense, first of all, to you?
Yes, I think it does.
Kim, what about you? Is Kim still with us? We should finish out with the recording. So any questions about any of this? Any questions about the notions of it, the principles, or the application?
No, I don't think so. Not for me.
One thing to keep in mind is that when you think about the focus to align the energy field of the brain, now, the focus frames presupposes that somebody is more organized or able to be more of an organizer in an auditory way. Now, some people will organize more in a visual way. So sometimes, let me give you an example of this. I had a woman I worked with who particularly wanted to work on optimizing her state and getting into a peak state for what she was about to do. She was about to appear each day for a week on Oprah as a guest and went through a series of things, and she wanted to be in an optimum state. She was a much more visual person. So what she came to was her cue was, I think, to touch a medallion that she wore each time that was not visible. But then her focus was to envision herself in a cone of white, bright light that was warm and soothing. So that took care of the physical and the focus at the same time, to be in this cone white, warm, protective light. It got her grounded and centered. She did it right before she walked out each time, and she was in an optimum state. So remember, when you're talking about visualizations with somebody or a focus phrase, which is auditory, remember if somebody's more auditory or visual or kinesthetic, so that you can have, you can help them fit this into what is a more primary way of organizing and doing things still. So that's something just to keep in mind. Thoughts?
Okay.
Anything else, thoughts or questions, Tom?
No, not at all. No, I think it makes a lot of sense, and it's very familiar to me.
Super.
Yeah.
Well, good. Okay, well, I'm going to send off the things that I mentioned as attachments to you. I'll get on that right now and hope that it'll be helpful to you. So we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Getting together with everybody next time. Bye now. Have a good night.